Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Super Subcast, Episode 3. I am your host, Ian Stewart, and with me today, I have my co-host, Nader Afuni. Nader, how's it going, man?
Hey, not bad, man. How's it going with you?
Pretty well. Just watched the Arsenal game. It's a Friday. I'm going to have some beers later. Anything with you?
That's crazy. Sounds like we have the exact same plans.
Yeah, there's nothing really special going on when there's a Friday night football. Anyway. Yeah. On today's episode, we're going to go over some Champions League games that happened previously this week. We're going to discuss our topic, which I'll let you introduce in a couple seconds. And then we're going to round it up with some EPL games that happened and then the game coming this weekend. So, Nader, what is our topic today?
Yeah, so we've got a good one today. The topic for today is, who the heck is Brentford FC? So, newly promoted side, plenty of excitement around their recent performances and their manager and their team in general. So we thought we'd use today's episode as an opportunity to deep dive into the club, who they are, who their owner is, and all that good stuff. But I think a good place to start is the European games that happened this past week. Do you want to start off with maybe Moscow versus Leicester?
Yeah, it was a pretty intense game. Spartak, they were all over them. They went up in the 44th minute, actually, to Jordan Larson, Henrik Larsson's son. Good goal. He looked really lively. And then a couple, like a minute later, actually, Patson Daka, who is a new signing for Leicester, made it 2-1 right before the break. And then coming back into the game, somehow Daka just went on a complete tear and ended up scoring 4 goals.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, it's been interesting. I mean, Leicester have been struggling through the European campaign, and I think they were sitting at the bottom of the table during the game, and they were looking destined for another defeat when they were 2-0 down. But like you said, I mean, Daka's introduction into the Leicester squad has been incredible. I think it's been a little gradual given just the striking force of Jamie Vardy, but watching the highlights, I mean, his game mirrors Vardy's in many ways. Just he finds the space between the lines and behind the lines so tactfully.
Yeah,
he's extremely clinical, and I don't know, just the way he scores, the way he finishes, it's just remarkably simple. And I think in the third and fourth goal especially, he showed a lot of strength, which for a young striker is really, really important to show that you have that physicality to show up on the defenders.
Yeah, and he definitely has that pace and definitely that clinical finishing. And funny enough, this actually isn't a Champions League game. This is a Europa League game.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about because it ended up being 4-3 in the end. Leicester pick up some points. I believe they're now in third in their group.
Yeah. Did they jump? It was like a massive jump that they had done when they ended up winning the game, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to look that up actually real quick. But
yeah. Yeah.
A big win for Brendan Rodgers because he really needs to get some. The thing about Brendan, he doesn't really perform too well in Europe. I know last year they got knocked out, surprisingly. And then this year they've started off pretty poorly. So they're 1-1-1 right now. And they're currently tied in third with Napoli. Or tied in second, I guess, with Napoli. Actually, that makes no sense. Leicester's in third. Saint level on points with Napoli is what I was trying to say. They have just a goal differential of 2. So at the top of the table, it's Liga, Warsaw, Napoli, Leicester, and then Spartak Moscow.
Yeah.
Seems like a good group.
We got to fire our research intern just making us look bad during these episodes.
Yeah.
But I mean, there were some good glimmers from the game. Just, you know, great partnership between Iheanacho and Daka. I think both are fantastic understudies to Vardy. And a lot of this is a real testament to the recruitment team over at Leicester. I mean, Daka, Sumare, who moved in from Lille.
Yeah, he looks like a good player. He was really driving that midfield to provide Daka the goals.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because when he was at Lille, he was traditionally just your traditional center midfielder holding. But, you know, Brendan is trying to evolve his game and create a greater impact at the top end of the field. So I think he's trying to turn him into this box-to-box midfielder. So, no, you're totally right. I mean, he could become a really good channel for the strikers. And you know, also just unrelated, but on the note of good signings over at Leicester, they brought in some great experienced players from Southampton, like Vestergaard and Bertrand. So,
yeah, you know, great addition. I don't know how well Vestergaard actually has been performing based on what I've seen from some of the Leicester fans in their mm-hmm. comments.
Yeah.
But on paper, he's a good signing from Southampton. I think they only got him for like 15 million.
Yeah. And then Ryan Bertrand, I think, came in. Was it free or was there a fee?
Also from Southampton. No, yeah, he came on a free.
He was on a free. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, he's a fan. I really loved watching him at Southampton. I thought he was a pivotal player at that team. And yeah, great addition.
Yeah, he just has to find his footing in that Leicester side. Anyway, let's move on to the next game.
Yeah, a little bit of bias attack in this one. Uh-huh.
Your heart attack of the week, Liverpool at Madrid, Atletico Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you start this game off. What an intense game.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I mean, great overall performance, I think, from both teams. You could tell there was a lot of hunger in the game, a lot of, like, relentless attitude, and it was really choppy at parts. I mean, I think Atletico are known as being sort of the bad boys. We'll get a result at any cost. We'll sort of play the victim card. But I thought both teams were out there playing to win. It was a really good game to watch as a neutral. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a dream start for us. I probably shouldn't convey my bias in these episodes. It was a great start for Liverpool.
No, definitely convey your bias.
Well, we saw just more glimmers of Salah's class with the first goal. I know, it took that little nip off Milner or the defender. Honestly, the replays, the more I watch them, the less sure I am. But Naby Keita's screamer as well, kind of looking like the one at Crystal Palace or against mm-hmm. Crystal Palace. But
he can really strike the ball pretty well. It's another good long shot goal he's had.
Yeah, the technique was immense. He kind of mm-hmm. just waited for it to land exactly where he wanted it and then sliced through it. It was so impressive.
Yeah. And every time I watch Mo play, he usually cuts up like two or three players in a sequence. And I usually just out loud just say, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. And then he ends up scoring somehow. He's amazing though. He's on fire.
His play is so Messi-esque. It's just, you know, really close touches on the ball, lots of touches. Kind of work like slicing through the defenders, really hard to dispossess, and then he just mm-hmm. finds that clinical moment to shoot. But I will say, as beautiful as that run up to the goal was, that solo run up, had mm-hmm. it not taken that little deflection, I think it was going straight to Oblak. But who cares?
Who cares?
Beautiful, yeah.
Anyway, so Liverpool go up 2-0, what, after like 10-15 minute mark?
Yeah, it was within, I think, the 13th minute we were 2-0 up.
Yeah, everything was going your way. But, you know, Atletico, they have really good fans. Simeone is a maniac and just, I think he like orchestrates them a lot when they're trying mm-hmm. to get like momentum going, which I kind of like seeing coaches do. Klopp used to do that a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, they came back. Griezmann, he got a kind of a cross from outside the box and tapped it in on the first goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then funny enough, actually, after equalizing Griezmann again, 2-2, he gets a red card in the second half. What'd you make of that?
Yeah, lots of discussion around that. And honestly, I was really shocked when people on the internet were saying, and various forums were saying, oh, you know, he had his eyes on the ball, his intent was to win the ball, et cetera, et cetera. I was talking to a friend of mine that you know, referees games at a semi-professional level, I suppose, and he made a really interesting point. He was saying that as a referee, you can never take intent into consideration. You're meant to evaluate the tackle as it is, without taking the intent of the player into consideration. And if we're just going to look at what had happened at face value, Griezmann had a high boot, you know, studs up, and it went right into Firmino's face. So that's a straight red. I was really surprised that there was discussion around it, but maybe that's just me, but straight red in my opinion.
A red card in my opinion.
Oh, all right.
No, I'm just joking. No, I thought it was pretty careless from Griezmann, just sticking up his boot, cleats up. And you can't really defend it because he catches him like in the neck / jaw area. And yeah, it's a red card all day. I know people talk about his intentions, but it's just a very dangerous play.
Yeah.
Because it was at his head level. It wasn't mm-hmm. like Firmino was like ducking down or anything.
Exactly. Exactly the point I wanted to just make. Yeah, He wasn't ducking. He kind of had his head bending a bit, but that was because he was going in to head the ball. But yeah, Griezmann's boot, it was just careless, really high up, straight red. And I was surprised there was any protest at all. But yeah.
But even with that, it was still a hard game to win because you guys end up getting a penalty. I think definitely a penalty, gets tackled in the box.
Mm-hmm.
Good penalty. And then, funny enough, on the other side, the ref calls a penalty for
same player.
Yeah, Atletico Madrid, and VAR turns it over. What'd you make of that one?
It was soft. It was soft. And honestly, biases aside, he went down really easily.
Mm-hmm.
Very little contact. I think Jota was just running across him to get ball side as it was coming over them.
Yeah.
He was fishing for it. And I'm glad the referee went to the pitch side screen to review it because there was nothing in it.
I could have seen it though going the other way. In my eyes, it was kind of like a toss-up. And with VAR nowadays, you don't really know how the refs affected, especially playing in Madrid,
mm-hmm.
down 3-2 with a red card. So, but yeah, great result for you guys, huh?
Yeah. I just want to say, we were talking about how stunning Keita was. I mean, despite that wonder goal, and this could be a topic for another time, but I just don't think he's good enough to be at the club. I keep giving it chance after chance, and I've always been the benefit of the doubt kind of guy. But Klopp clearly identified the pain point in the team that evening and took him off at halftime to bring in Fabinho, which as an armchair analyst, I think should have been the move to begin with. But he struggled as a defensive option, he struggled as an attacking option, he struggled as a holding option, and I really think it lies in his physicality on and off the ball. I would argue that Keita was at fault for Griezmann's first goal. He kind of just allowed Lemar to stride past him. It was really, really easy to get past Naby Keita. And then same thing for the second goal. I think as a number eight role, you need to really be controlling that area. And he just did not do enough to subdue João Felix's run in the build-up to the second goal. But like I said, strong opinion, maybe for another time, but I don't think he's justified his £50 million plus price tag that we brought him in for.
Yeah, I don't know if you look at that price tag, he's probably worth that much. He's definitely struggled trying to get in that first team spot since he's come, though, to the club.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to our next game, which is Man United versus Atalanta.
Yeah.
This game was in Manchester. Another really intense game. A lot of pressure on Ollie right now. Performances haven't gone their way. They realistically should be challenging for the Premier League title. Right now, it doesn't look like it. Ollie hasn't been doing too well in recent times in Europe, so a win at home is very needed after losing to Young Boys in Switzerland. Yeah, Atalanta, they kind of play, I've heard a lot of comparisons to the manager, but it's very like Bielsa-like. It's very attacking.
Mm-hmm.
They play three at the back. They're really fun to watch, and they kind of bring that Italian energy. So they end up going down Man United 2-0, and that's how the half ends, actually. And for whatever reason, Ollie just must have given them a really heated team talk because they end up coming back 3-2. What did you make of the match?
Yeah, the uneasy atmosphere in the stadium the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You can just sense the tension. Like, everyone wants him fired. Poor guy.
Cut it with a butter knife. The fans made it clear. Players and the manager being booed off and jeered off at the end of the first half. I think one of the reasons, I think there's a lot of reasons why the fans, the players were frustrated at the end of the first half. Atalanta are a fantastic team, but United were being beaten on textbook things. I think one of the goals had come in from a corner, and you don't want to get beaten on set pieces, but fantastic response from the team. Really, really strong response. And, I think Cristiano Ronaldo being on that team has just brought that winning mentality, that win at all costs mentality. That's really charged the team. But one thing I'm curious about is how Liverpool reacted to that result going into this weekend's Premier League fixture.
Oh, I'm sure they were watching it. And we'll get to that game later in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the goals, Rashford had a good goal. I thought Maguire, he basically got across from the back post and took it one time.
Yeah,
it was a striker's finish by the £80 million man. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Luke Shaw crossing in for the last goal and Ronaldo scoring it last minute. Textbook Ronaldo.
Yeah. And De Gea making some vital saves too to retain, to sort of keep Man United in the game as well.
Yeah, he's a good keeper. I think we should have a debate on who's the best keeper in the Premier League. Maybe we'll get to that later in the episode as well.
For sure.
Anyway, our last game we're going to talk about during the Champions League was RB Leipzig versus PSG in Paris. Did you end up watching this game, Nader?
Yeah, I watched this one. Well, it was going on at the same time as the Liverpool game, so I had it on a different screen. I was kind of more focused on the Liverpool one, but caught most of the glimpses of this one.
Anything you can highlight? Because I'm not going to lie, I actually didn't watch this one.
You know, I think I can make more general points about it. This game was exciting. It was goal-fueled, but I want to talk about PSG more specifically as a Champions League contender.
Yeah, let's get into it.
I feel like it can be said, you know, every year for the past few years, but this has to be, if not the best PSG transfer window in history, just the best footballing transfer window in history. This is the best PSG side we've seen. I mean, they brought in Ramos, Wijnaldum, Donnarumma, who, you know, had an incredible Euro campaign. And mind you, all those names I just sort of run free transfers. And then you have Hakimi coming in for an insane fee. And with all that being said, they've also brought in Lionel Messi, who is still number one or number two, depending on who you ask in the world.
Yeah. Wasn't he also on a free as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, he was.
Oh, man. What an unreal transfer window. And yeah, there's definitely a lot of pressure for them to win this. What do you think of a Pochettino situation? Because yeah, he can't afford not to win every game, essentially, with that lineup you have.
I think there is a extremely heavy pressure sitting on Pochettino's shoulder in terms of the expectations of the Champions League. You know, we know he's capable of bringing a team to the final, as we saw with Tottenham in 2019. But, you know, he has all the firepower in the world that he could ask for. He can't complain about not having the manpower. He has a nice margin in Ligue 1 to sort of rest easy with, which, by the way, could be a double-edged sword. And I'll elaborate in a second, but I think the largest threats are going to be Manchester City and Liverpool. That being said, he has yet to add a big trophy to his cabinet, which definitely adds to the mental game of winning the Champions League. And PSG as a side, despite having great players, I think they have issues at the higher end of the field, the attacking, the final third. They have very traditional midfielders with the likes of Herrera, Verratti, Wijnaldum, you know, has yet to even make a name for himself, you know, but none are world-class playmakers. They're very traditional industrial midfielders. They don't have a Kevin De Bruyne. They don't have a Jorginho. They don't have a Bruno Fernandes. So you could argue that Di Maria fits that role, but PSG does have a bit of an imbalanced squad. But
I would also agree on the imbalance. When I look at their squad, one thing I think I don't think they're going to win the Champions League, by the way, but I think one area they can struggle in would be physicality. They're pretty small. The only big players they kind of really have is Marquinhos and Ramos. And then if Gigi's on the field, then yeah, he has that presence. I think they're really going to struggle in the later matches and the knockouts with like set pieces, like if they go against like a Bayern Munich or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was saying about the whole double-edged sword about Ligue 1. I think when you don't have an intense domestic league, it's hard to replicate the energy that you need for a Champions League night against an Ajax, against a Bayern Munich, against a Manchester City, et cetera, when you're not being consistently challenged in your domestic league. So yeah, like I said, you can look at it two ways. One is we're comfortable in Ligue 1 and that's less pressure on the domestic league, or we're not being challenged enough and therefore we can't sharpen that fierce competitive mentality that we need for the Champions League.
Yeah, Ligue 1 always has been kind of very top-heavy with PSG at the very top.
Yeah.
Anyway, good discussions on the Champions League games. Next, I want to kind of dive into our topic. But before the topic, I wanted to talk about the Chelsea-Brentford game that happened that ended with Chelsea 1, Brentford 0. It was at Brentford. I mean, what another good game. There's been some really good games of football this past week.
Yeah, and a lot of them have involved, I mean, yeah, this past week definitely, but I think in general in the Prem, a lot of the top games that strike my mind have included Brentford. Brentford, Chelsea, Brentford, Liverpool, both fantastic games to watch as a fan of either side or as a neutral. But yeah, what were some of your key moments of that game?
I think Chelsea was pretty good in the first half, but moving on to the second half, it was all Brentford for a good 25 to 35 minutes. They were just pounding Chelsea, just like a high press. And we'll get into Brentford's tactics during the deep dive on our topic today. They do a really good job of loading the back post. If you ever look at them on set pieces, I think they usually throw like three or four guys in the back post to head it across. And they had a couple of moments there. I think in Wemo hit the post once or twice, actually hit it twice. Someone had a crazy bicycle kick that in the 90th minute that Mendy had to save. Yeah, I really like Brentford. If you're neutral and you really want to watch entertaining football, just watch Brentford because they give a game to anyone. Because this is Chelsea. They're at the top of the Premier League. And to be honest, I think Brentford should have came away with some points at least.
I still think Frank and the entire fan base and the players walked off the field extremely proud of themselves.
Yeah, they definitely should keep their heads held high after that performance.
Yeah, I mean, they're writing an enticing first chapter to an incredible story of their first season in the Premier League. They're sitting in 10th right now, but the point margins are very thin, especially after the Arsenal game that just took place on the day we're recording this. But, you know, they've come in and they beat Arsenal, they beat Wolves, they beat West Ham, they've drawn against Liverpool in a really thrilling game we just talked about. But, you know, I don't think a neutral could have been any more captivated by Brentford's second half performance. You know, they were able to keep the Champions League winning side to 5 shots throughout the entire game. And, you know, I don't think that was because of very disciplined defending or maintaining a disciplined structure. I think that was more of a testament to the intensity that they played with that you were alluding to.
Very high intensity, always try to get the ball back. They do a really good job of utilizing their strengths, which is their forwards. They'll be really direct with them and it'll open up space for their wingers to get in behind the back line of their opponents. But I think they do a really good job of keeping it really high energy, which makes it difficult to for teams to compete with.
They were walking all over them for a great part of the second half. I mean, it was just always in Chelsea's side of the field, in Chelsea's box. So, yeah. I think very unlucky to not walk away with a draw. And you kind of alluded to Mbeumo hitting the post twice and, you know, forcing some Ivan Toney and a few others forcing some great saves out of Mendy. I mean, he had a man of the match performance that game.
Did he get man of the match? Because he definitely deserved it. He was unreal.
Yeah.
The bicycle kick save was amazing. The save on Toney was amazing as well.
Mm-hmm.
I really like him.
He's consistent too. I mean,
he is maybe very consistent and he's pretty good with the ball at his feet. I wouldn't say it's his biggest strength, but he can do it.
Yeah. I think this is a really good segue into our main topic for the episode, Brentford FC.
Yeah, man. Do you want to start us off with it?
Why not? So our main focus for this topic is to sort of examine their journey to the Premier League. So we want to mainly look at the last 5 years, especially since they're purchased by Matthew Benham, and then take a look at, you know, who they are as a club, what's their identity, what's their tactics been like under Coach Frank, and sort of an outlook on the club during their time in the Premier League and how we think they're going to perform as the season progresses. But yeah, I mean, if you'd like to deep dive into the early days after being purchased by Matthew Benham.
Yeah, so Matthew Benham actually came into... Maybe let's start with Matthew Benham. He's an interesting guy. So early on in his career, he's in his early to mid-50s currently.
Mm-hmm.
Early in his career, he began in finance, and he basically worked at Bank of America for 10-plus years and became a vice president. So he accumulated a good amount of money from that work. Then in, I think, 2001, he did a career change actually to sports gambling because he was very analytic heavy, which is a theme that he actually brings to Brentford. Later in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So he...
He's not just a Bank of America degenerate?
No, he's not just a Bank of America degenerate suit, making pitch books or whatever.
Yeah.
But essentially, yeah, he gets into sports gambling at this firm. He stays there for 2 years after falling out with the owner. He starts his own... I think starts one or two of his own sports gambling firms where he uses analytics to predict the scores of football matches.
Yeah.
So in 2004, he made a small fortune doing that. And fast forward to 2007, this is where he gets involved into the Brentford hierarchy, essentially, or his first inklings of it. So he provides a 700K loan to the fans so they can buy the club. Fast forward 5 years, there was a clause in their loan agreement that if the fans didn't pay it back, then Matthew would become the owner of the club, essentially. So that's what happened in 2012. He became the owner of Brentford.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, so kind of a everything I read about him is very rags to riches, just like sports gambling to owning a football club. It's honestly like the dream of anyone. Mm-hmm. I would love to do that.
Yeah, what about the times that sort of predated Matthew? I know that there were some movements in directors of football, directors of sport. You know, I think they had brought in Mark Warburton he was like previously their director of football and then moved to became their manager. I could be completely butchering this.
Going
on there?
So Matthew's in charge of the club now. Mm-hmm. He runs it. So in the 2013-14 season, the director of football, who everything I've read up on was the analytics guy. His name is Mark Warburton. He actually moves from the director of football to the head manager of the club, which I don't think you really see too often, but it's a very Renford move, I would say. Fast forward a year to the 2014-15 season, he actually ends up leaving the club because he has a fallout with the owner, Matthew, over direction of recruitment. Everything I've read, Matthew wanted to do more kind of a broad approach to analytics to getting players, and Warburton wanted to do a more narrow approach. So he leaves the club. Moving on to 2015-16, they appoint a new manager. After 9 games, they get rid of him and have an interim manager. And then at the end of that season, they actually bring in Dean Smith, who I just saw get slapped up by Arsenal 3-1. He comes in as the Brentford manager from Warsaw. And in that same year, they actually end up getting rid of their academy, which I don't know if you've read up on that. They did an analysis, essentially, that they didn't want to have an academy anymore and just have essentially a B team and an A team, with the A team being the first team that's competing. And I think the feeling behind this was when, since they're based in Western London. So when they're competing for these kids for their academies, they're competing against, you know, Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, QPR, every London based club, essentially, you know, Crystal Palace is in there. So it's really hard to attract talent. I think eventually, once, even though you get these academy players, they end up going to a different London club for more money. So they kind of did this money ball approach of just moving to a B team as opposed to have an academy. What are your thoughts over that?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. I mean, it is extremely competitive in London. I can't tell you off the top of my head how many clubs are there, but surely there's a lot of movement between the players, especially at the youth level, because, you know, geographically, you don't have to pack up or move different schools, especially that early of a stage in your footballing career. But it's really interesting, because the way I sort of viewed academies, especially at the upper side of the table, is, you know, they're essentially very cheap players that you have on your payroll that you can develop. And if they bust, that's fine. They just move on. You release them, they go to different clubs. And then you have the few that are breakout players. You know, at Liverpool, for example, you've got Trent Alexander-Arnold, Curtis Jones, and then you have others that you can sort of sell off. I mean, Rehan Brewster, we had by some miracle done some of the greatest transfer work ever and got, I think, north of £20 million for him. So, you know, academies
for Brewster.
Yeah.
That guy, whoever did that, that transfer needs a,
give him 20% of that deal.
Yeah. Needs a brown envelope, I think.
Yeah. But that was sort of my view, but it makes sense for a club like Brentford to really pool its resources and its focus in developing two very strong sides and not making the maybe unnecessary investment in their eyes on an academy structure. So I actually commend it. I like the idea of a local person breaking through, but I guess in London, whether you played for QPR, Leighton Orient, Tottenham, whoever it may be, you're still technically a local guy.
Yeah.
Breaking definitely into the team. Yeah. So that's really fascinating. And I can't even think of any other clubs that have done something similar.
I haven't really read anything on any other clubs doing it. It kind of makes sense though, from an economic standpoint, because if you're a smaller club like Brentford, like how are you going to compete with the Arsenals, the Chelseas, because they just have so much more money than you.
Yeah.
And this kind of, I think everything from I read from Matthew Benham, he's always looking for that little edge. And if you've ever read Moneyball, it's a really good book. Mm-hmm. He's kind of taken that analytics-based approach where they look for undervalued players using analytics, bring them in, to their club and then sell them for a huge profit. And I don't know if you want to get into any of the players through the years, their history, but they have made some big boy profits, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I know just in our research, we sort of looked at some of the transfers that they've made, but you know, I think from a starting 11 standpoint, and I'll let you take away sort of the transfers that they've made and the clever, you know, sales and intakes that they made just to sort of maintain a self-sustaining model as a club. Mm-hmm. But I think from a starting 11 standpoint or a squad standpoint, they've actually been fairly consistent. I mean, if you compare their 2019-20 start of the season roster compared to now that they've been promoted, I think they've maintained a lot of the same players. They definitely brought in a lot of players when they were very serious about breaking into the Premier League. I think most of the midfield was actually signed in 2019, the one that we know today. Yeah, but very, very tactical with their sales. You know, names that really stick out, Ollie Watkins, Benrahma, Mopai. You know, like these are big names that you wouldn't have thought went through the Brentford system.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of a dollar amount, they bought Watkins for £6.5 million, sold him to Villa for 30. Mope, they got him from St. Etienne for a little under $2 million, sold him for 20. So it's a 10x right there.
Yeah.
Benrahma got him from France for $1.5 million, sold him to West Ham for a little north of $20 million. So they make some really good profits. And in doing this, if you look back their last 7 years, they've been kind of moving the goalposts where you can buy these players for under $1 million, sell them for, you know, maybe $10 million. And then a year later, you can buy players for $3 to $5 million and then end up selling those players for $30 million. So while they're having a churn of top talent, they're making money, they're reinvesting it back into the club, which is what is needed for a self-staying model. And if you have ambition like Brentford to get to the Premier League, you need to keep bringing in that quality.
Yeah. And it sounds like they've been huge beneficiaries of the Premier League market premium, if you know what I mean. I feel like a player is worth plus 10 mil when you sell him in the Premier League market.
Oh, yeah. And if he's English, then it's like a 20 mil.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think another good point is something that we hadn't mentioned was the owner also has an interest in FC, and I'm going to butcher the name, Midtjylland.
That was butchered.
My God. Give it to me. Midtjylland?
That was good. FC Midtjylland.
Midtjylland.
The champions of Denmark. And yeah, I guess I didn't go into this, but the
sorry
owner
to our Danish listeners.
Yeah, sorry, our Danish listeners. He also owns this club, which he bought, I think, for like 10 million. And he's been using them essentially as like a guinea pig to do real Moneyball stuff. And he's taken that model of buying undervalued players to Brentford. And he also uses this club to as like a farm team almost. Like I believe Onyeka, the center midfielder, just joined from FC Midtjylland. He had a good season last year, and now he's in Brentford. I really like him. I think he looks good.
Yeah, I mean, 23 years old, capped by Nigeria. That's good business.
Yeah, so I would say Brentford is a very self-sustained model, but let's get back in the timeline, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So Dean Smith has been hired. They get rid of their academy. Going into 2016-17, they finish 10th. Going into the following season, 2017-18, they finish 9th. So they're kind of still in that mid-table level of the championship, but they're ambitious and they want to get to the premiership. Come the 18-19 season, actually, Dean Smith is appointed by Aston Villa and actually gets them promoted. So our main man of the hour comes in, Thomas Frank, who actually was the assistant head coach.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually starts managing the club. And at the end of that season, they finish 13th. Do you want to dive in a little bit about, Thomas Frank?
Thomas Frank. Yeah. Interesting background on him. I think you kind of dived into this a bit, but you know, 18 years in youth coaching systems. He had spells as a manager in, Danish youth systems. And he became a senior manager at Brøndby in 2013. But yeah, I mean, he was, he was named as a manager of the Danish Superliga club in 2013. So that being his first senior position. And you know, he did fairly well. He achieved fourth and third place finishes respectively in the 13-14 season and 14-15 season. So he was able to bring European football to the team, Europa League, obviously. You know, there was some disappointment there. He was unable to lead them into the group stages in either season. But in there was a bit of a falling out sometime in early 2016. He had gotten some criticism from the chairman. And there was a weird story about this. I think it had come from the chairman, but on a supporters forum. And the chairman kind of used a fake name or something.
Yeah, used a burner account to talk shit about his manager.
Yeah, I mean, that's that just kind of that makes me think of like, you know, an author going in on other people's books and just talking shit or like just
talking mad shit.
Or like, yeah, you know, that's those pretty... those politicians that forget to switch their Twitter accounts when they reply to their own tweets in support.
But yeah, he ends up leaving Brøndby and then gets appointed as the assistant coach at Brentford. Dean Smith goes to Villa. Now he's the head coach. So going into his first season, his first full season with the summer transfer window, they actually end up finishing third and they make the playoff in the championship. They end up losing to Fulham, unfortunately. So they don't get that Premier League promotion. And I remember watching that game. I was so sad. One, because I thought Brentford looked like a good team. They're fun to watch. And I just really didn't want to see Fulham in the Prem again.
We watched it together.
Did we? Where?
We did. It was at your place, your parents' place. The game had ended 2-1.
Yeah, it was a good game, but I was just like, Fulham in the Prem again, like, and then they got relegated the following year.
Mm-hmm.
Typical Fulham. Anyway, so they come up short. The next year, kind of the same story. They miss out on the top two spots. They finish third again and they make the playoff. And I think a lot of the fans are worrying, is it going to be the story of last season? Like, we've come so close. We've done so many years of good management of players and recruitment. Can we just get to the Premier League? And lo and behold, they end up winning promotion by beating, I think it was Swansea. I think it was 2-0, I believe. They get promoted in the 2021 season.
Yeah, incredible story. And you know what? They were never really on my radar until that 2-1 Fulham game. I always watched the playoffs pretty closely, and they were a really exciting team. And I think that there was a lot of people rooting for them because they were going to be that new name in the league.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was very disappointing to watch them lose 2-1 to Fulham. But followed them the next season, and it was clear that they were coming back. Just such a strong team, high performing, and they almost looked like they could have taken on maybe the bottom six teams in the Prem at the time when they were still fighting for promotion.
Oh, I'm sure they could. I bet you can make that argument for most championship teams, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's
at the top, obviously, like the top, you know, four or whatever.
Yeah, there's always that argument for the standout teams in the championship. There's often this argument that they have much busier schedules. The players are typically much fitter, less squad rotation, and just given the level that they have to consistently perform at. To finish in the top six for a playoff shot or to get promoted directly through the position, they can very easily take on, you know, the bottom six struggling sides of the Premier League. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they've taken that mentality coming into this season because when you're in the championship's a hard league to perform in. There's a lot of matches you got to play as you brought up the physicality. And I think they've definitely brought that energy and stamina to the Premier League this season, which has been a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. I mean, they're also just generally a very exciting team. Like we said, they're a very high scoring side. And you know, during their last two championship campaigns, they had scored 80 and 79 goals respectively. And they just have such a bias for all out attacking football. You know, they had the second most shots, 607, I believe. and 668 in the last two campaigns before promotion. So you know, by all intents and purposes, I think they were already playing at a Premier League level prior to promotion, especially those last two seasons in the run-up to getting promoted.
Yeah, and bring in Tony, and he ended up winning the Golden Boot for the championship that year. I actually think he broke the record for the most goals in a season. I think it was like 33.
My God.
33, 34. Yeah, unreal.
Wow.
Unreal for
30 goals.
That was after winning the breaking the record for League One with Peterborough. So, yeah, bringing in that high caliber striker will definitely help you getting promoted, and they end up getting promoted. So, what do you like most about Brentford? I know we've kind of talked about it already, like they're high pressing, good energy. But what do you specifically
do? We want to talk about like the make you feel soft inside kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah, I mean, some of the gooey stuff. I remember at the beginning of the season, there was that one fan that sort of reached out to Frank and, you know, was like extending his arms on the air. And then Frank went and picked him up and carried him around the field. And that was really warming. And I think if you listen to him during interviews, a lot of managers admire the way he carries himself in interviews. He's very he never lacks conviction. He's very direct. He's very sure in what he says, and he's a very confident guy, and he backs what he says. So I think there's just a really strong spirit in the club, and that connects through the fans, through the manager, through the players. And I really think just that strong, positive, pragmatic attitude is what's carrying them really strong through the league right now. So I just admire the spirit of the club. There's a real deep connection between every facet of the club.
Yeah, it's one of those clubs that still has that community feel, for sure. Because they just built a new stadium. I think it's like 18,000 capacity. And from what I can tell, the matches look amazing to be in there. And the players are behind the fans are behind the players. Frank obviously has a good connection with them, getting them promoted. And yeah, he's a very confident guy. And I think he should be. They have a little bit of swagger, Brentford. I like it.
Yeah, and having your fans back in the stadium, especially this season at full capacity, just has to make the difference.
I mean, I know it means so much to them because a lot of them were just probably just dying to watch for an entire year.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, maybe I mean, if we can carry on and talk a little bit more about what they do as tactics, or we can just dive into, you know, sort of who they are as a club. What are you feeling? Let's meander a bit. What direction do you want to take this?
So I think in terms of tactics, let's do a brief overview. So they play a 3-5-2 currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have Tony and Mbeumo up top, who are a great pair, both very physical.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I can tell, they like to play really direct up to them, narrow the field, which actually leaves their left wing and right wing fullbacks to create space. The center defensive mid, when they have possession, will drop real deep. So it lets the midfielders and the wingers roam a bit, and the forwards, Tony and Mbeumo, actually stretch the field. So it's very, very fast paced. When they lose the ball, they're very high pressing. They're trying to get the ball back quickly as possible. If they do win the ball, they might whip it out wide, and then the wide player will send it to the back post. I always see them go to the back post a lot, which actually kind of makes sense, because in the Chelsea game is a good example of that. When you're playing players that are technically a higher caliber than yours, being Chelsea, Brentford, a fight at the back post up in the air, it's pretty 50-50, especially if you have some of the big boys that they have on their team that they can win those battles. That's where I think they bring that championship mindset, like real physical, like fighting for every 50-50 ball.
Yeah.
That's what I really like about them. Uh-huh. Yeah. Get in their faces and just try to make it difficult for the opposition.
It's interesting. I mean, there's such an emphasis of playing on the left side of the field with Brentford. I mean, if you look at some of the heat maps that have been coming out just on the Premier League website and on the BBC and whatnot, you see that the ball is plenty cycled around sort of the left center backs, the center midfielder. So usually the ball sort of rotating between Pinnock and around Norgaard. There's a bias towards playing on the left side of the field mm-hmm. in order to feed it over to Mbeumo and Tony. And mm-hmm. and on top of that, what's really fascinating is a lot of the play does come from the goalkeeper too. So despite the cycling of the ball on the left side of the field and moving the ball up to the left and creating those channels, Raya has played a very direct role. Yeah, I mean, his distribution is fantastic.
Yeah, he's really good. He's like a poor man's Allison, I would say. That might be a shot in the dark at him, but yeah. I think he's really good with his feet. It's very evident that they utilize that part, and he's also just a good keeper. Mm-hmm. He's made some pretty decent saves. In terms of the left side, I think they're trying to isolate Rico Henry, who's their left fullback, left wing back, and he likes to get up and down the field, and he has a bit of pace on him. So mm-hmm. I think their goal is always try to create space for on the outside, stretch the opposing team to get in one-on-one situations.
Yeah. And I think one of the arguments against the 3-5-2 is it leaves you very exposed, but I still think they play quite a compressed 3-5-2. They like to push their defenders quite high up with the central midfielders and the wingbacks. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a great deal of discipline there, and it sort of fits the narrative of very in-your-face, high-intensity, high-pressure football. So they've executed it extremely well so far.
Definitely. And I actually want to ask you this question. Like, how do you, they started off very well. I think you alluded in the episode earlier in the episode that they're in 10th or 11th place right now.
They're sitting in 10th after the Arsenal game today.
Okay. So I would say a newly promoted side who has had some tough matches already and gotten some pretty good results. Where do you see them performing the rest of the season, especially in that second half? Do you think their experience in the championship will let them keep driving forward, or do you think they might get burned out a little bit?
I think experience in the championship plays a great deal in this. They do have a bit of fixture
congestion.
Congestion, yes, thank there you. with some of the domestic ties coming up too, but just to look, they've got Leicester coming up, which is by no means an easy game this weekend, and then they've got Stoke in the midweek, and then I don't want to say
they have Stoke.
They do have Stoke away. Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna have to watch away. Oh, I gotta watch that game. It's gonna be just physical, just strikers going up with center backs, elbows flying everywhere.
Yeah,
Stoke away, hardest place to play in the world as well.
It'll be a good one. And then
what's that in the League Cup? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh no, you're fine. Yeah, that's the League Cup.
Okay.
Yeah, round of 16 too. So.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't want to call it a stroll, but they've got Burnley coming up on Saturday, which, you know, like you were just saying, another really physical team,
mm-hmm.
Kind of the Atletico Madrid of England, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Love the playing.
Atletico Madrid
card.
Of England.
maybe not in names and quality, but like similar mentality. They're just, you know, mm-hmm. like thugs, you know, they're down to get dirty. They play the victim card often. They'll dish the tackles, but then the moment they feel them, they'll hit the ground. And
what? They play the victim card?
Oh,
Burnley?
Oh my God. Just watch some Sean Dyche interviews after this recording.
Oh, I get this. You're doing your Liverpool bias because him and Klopp hate each other.
What are you talking about?
They don't like each other though, right? You remember seeing that video of them cursing each other out?
Yeah, he's I don't want to dive in. But he's another guy that just kind of like holds the whole like stadium atmosphere in his palm, kind of like mm-hmm. Simeone. They love him. But anyway.
Yeah. Oh, Simeone. I forgot to bring that up. He also didn't shake Klopp's hand.
No, he
didn't. People don't like shaking Klopp's hand. Do you think he just doesn't wash his hands or something?
I mean, I think Simeone just heat of the moment kind of thing. But he's a see you next Tuesday. You know, like he'll like fucking grasp his crotch to the crowd and he'll go happily shake Klopp's hand when they win at Anfield.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but
I think Simeone should have like two or three like gold chains, no tie.
Yeah. The only bit of class about him is the suit he wears. But I mean, to be fair, I think he came out after the game and he didn't really directly apologize, but he kind of explained, you know, it's very heat in the moment and,
mm-hmm.
you know, he respects Klopp and all that. So I think it was just all for appearances.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, back to Burnley being just like Atletico Madrid. Yeah, they've got Burnley away. They've got Norwich, Newcastle. Everton's going to be a tough tie. But I mean, to be quite honest, they have a fairly manageable run-up into December. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they can get the majority of the points there, they'll create a good buffer for themselves, because come December, it's not going to be easy. They have Brighton, City within 3 days of each other. And then they also have United the week prior. So
mm-hmm.
not an easy run-up of fixtures. So I think they really have to secure those points against Norwich, Burnley, Newcastle. I think they can get something Tottenham away. But yeah, I mean, in terms of a future outlook, I think they're playing the right football. I think they've shown that they're very fearless. They're very, very strong. And the brand of football they're playing right now is working very well for them. It's breaking teams down. It's stopping teams from getting to their half from an attacking standpoint. Yeah, I hope the winter period doesn't wear them out.
Like a star collapsing on itself.
Yeah, I mean, and I hope they don't get the second season blues as unceremoniously as Sheffield felt them. That was just night and day.
I think you called, I remember going into that season, Sheffield got relegated.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was like, yeah, they're going to do pretty well. And you're like, no, they're terrible. And you were right.
Yeah, I think just project restart and everything that came before that really slowed the momentum that they had going on. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think they were just too reliant on an aging, you know, League One championship level squad.
Can only get you so far in the Prem, huh?
Exactly.
So what place do you see? Give me your prediction. What place is Brentford?
I like that. I would be pleased if they finished in eighth. I would be thrilled if they finished in sixth.
You think they could finish in sixth?
That means doing better than Everton. That means doing better than Arsenal. Those are sort of the hurdles at mm-hmm. the moment. I don't know. I mean, I think the real team standing in their way right now, West Ham, Everton, Arsenal, mm-hmm. if they can outperform them, I can easily see them finishing seventh, sixth. But I think 10th place is a realistic goal for them to stick to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've already beaten West Ham and Arsenal season opener.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think 10th place is a realistic goal for them to finish. I think as we went through their history, mm-hmm. everything was kind of they had a plan and they had a trajectory and they kind of did baby steps all the way through the championship those five years and they got promoted. I think that might be, I just think they're such a well-run club. I think that's how their story in the Prem is going to go. I don't see them, I don't know, I see them finishing 10th to 12th this season, which I think is a good season coming in your first Premier League season.
Yeah, and it gives you manageable and realistic goals for the next season going forward in terms of where you want to finish and what you want to achieve and who you want to bring in.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this team for years to come, because I don't think they're going anywhere, and I think they're just going to get better.
I really hope they're a Brighton situation. You know, Brighton came into the league in 2017, if I'm not mistaken, and they've kind of cemented themselves in the Premier League. It doesn't, maybe a few scary battles and the bottom side of the table here and there, but they've had such a solid start and they've created a really strong foundation for themselves. So I hope Brentford can do the same.
I think they will. I think Brighton didn't do so well last year because they mm-hmm. just weren't very efficient. They didn't have that striker, even though I don't think Mopé was performing as well as he is this season. Anyway, yeah, I think that was a good topic. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, just looking forward to the upcoming fixtures. Yeah, excited to see how they weather sort of that December to February period. And I think Man City will be a fun game to watch them play towards the end of December. But no, yeah. I think this was a fantastic topic and good to shed some light on this newcomer into the Premier League and maybe just add some of the more behind the scenes stuff to all the incredible stuff they've been doing on the field recently.
Yeah, they definitely have been getting some praise, as they should.
Yeah,
I know. I usually try to watch all their games, and I think we usually text each other during their games. They're just so mm-hmm. much fun to watch, and I would recommend it to anyone to watch them.
Yeah, and for listeners that don't know, Ian's actually in Calgary right now, and I'm in Austin, Texas. So we do these podcasts over Zoom, and just an awesome way for us to keep in touch as friends and keep us on top of the footballing world too.
Definitely. Our friendship is solely based on Brentford Football Club.
transcends the Canadian border.
Anyway, yeah, good topic.
What's coming up this weekend?
Oh man, this is your weekend, my guy. What are your plans? Liverpool, Man United at Old Trafford Sunday morning, huh?
Yeah, catch me 4 Guinnesses deep by 9 a.m.
There's nothing better than a Guinness on a really good game.
It's a breakfast beer. It's a breakfast beer.
Got to have a minimum of 2.
Yeah. No, one per half is usually my rule of thumb, but you never know when a game is going really well and, you know, the corner creepers at the bar start buying shots for everyone.
Do you eat breakfast before?
I have my breakfast at home usually, yeah. And then I'll have the brews and the coffee at the bar.
Oh, you got to get the coffee. The coffee with the Guinness, it's a must. Anyway, so what are your thoughts on going on this game? I think this is more pressure on Man United, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's always an exciting fixture. I think Man United are riding the high of coming back from 2-0 down against Atalanta. So I think Ollie and his players have a lot more pressure on their shoulder going to this game. There was a lot of scare against Atalanta. But I think, I don't know if they'll outwardly say it, but I think their current target now is to at least get past or match Liverpool. So they're already on the back foot as it stands. And, you know, I don't think Liverpool are unsure or hesitant. I don't think there'll be any changes to their system or to their game. It's been working extremely well, and I see them doing the same at Old Trafford. And, you know, some encouraging news, Curtis Jones is a potential squad member on the trip to Old Trafford, but, you know, Thiago's still out injured, and, you know, fixture congestion with internationals has just been our biggest enemy, especially mm-hmm. with our South American players.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think is the key to victory for you guys?
Key to victory against Man United, I think just don't fall into the pressure of the crowd, because, you know, those matches just get really ruthless from mm-hmm. the stands. And I think being very vigilant and having a good sense of containment of Ronaldo, Bruno Fernandes, I think they're the standout players on the side right now. And if you can subdue them, then you can really break the Man United approach, the Man United system.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting how Klopp, decides to set up the mentality of this game. Do you think, on one hand, I could see it being a pretty cagey match because Man United are at home, and if they go 1 or 2 goals down in the first half, the fans will, I think, will turn on them just because it's Liverpool.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of pressure on the team right now, but I don't know if it's like Klopp to lower the intensity. I could also see Man United playing the counter because they do that quite well. And maybe they'll try to hit the break on Liverpool. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to this game. Do you have any predictions of the score?
I think the professional...
A non-biased prediction?
I think like the predictions coming in are like 1-1. But I want to go in and smell like 3-0. I want it to be a convincing win at Old Trafford.
You want to bury them, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Put the nail in the coffin.
Oh, man, you're a bad guy. You want to see little kids and Man U kids cry.
Nothing better.
Yeah, no, I think you guys are gonna, well, let me look at the league table, because if Man United not win this, where are they gonna be sitting?
So they're sitting what,
be pretty
sixth at the moment. Yeah, so Man United are sitting sixth at the moment,
mm-hmm.
With a very narrow gap between Tottenham, Brighton. They could even close it with City. So yeah, if they lose this, they've kind of shot themselves in the foot, because the gap is just so sweet right now.
Mm-hmm.
But a win for us will be great, because we're also breathing down Chelsea's necks at the minute, and City are doing the same with us.
I love that you guys are performing this season. I think coming into it, we had a discussion. You guys had enough firepower to win the Prem, but you definitely do.
Yeah, dude.
If you guys stay healthy, I think you guys could win it. Really.
I was a doubter. I was one of those really worried guys about not bringing in signings. And then on top of Harvey Elliott, you know, being out for the season,
mm-hmm.
definitely one of the more anxious fans, but this has just been a pleasure to watch, like overtures of the 2019-20 season.
Yeah. And I think this season it's going to be a 3-horse race.
Yeah.
With Chelsea, you guys, and Man City. But I think later in the season, we'll really see if not strengthening the squad will come into play, because you have a couple key players that if they get injured, if Mo Salah, Mane, or Van Dijk get injured,
mm-hmm.
you're in trouble.
I agree. I agree.
Yeah, so I'm going to go with a – ooh, that's my prediction. I'm going to go 2-1 Liverpool. I'm going to give you the win.
All right. Appreciate it. I hope you can.
I hope I'll be watching it. I might go buy some Guinness, actually. It's like I'm drinking with you. We can FaceTime in the bar.
Yeah. Cheers to you, pal.
Are there any other games you want to talk about before we wrap up the episode?
I think the other only standout, honestly, pretty boring list of game. No disrespect to the other clubs, but I think
it's not a good weekend, is it?
No, the only real other standout one is Brentford Leicester, and we haven't talked about Brentford at all this episode. We should bring the
who Brent who.
Brentford Leicester. I don't know. Do you have any opinions on this one?
Yeah, so it's at Brentford, which I like their stadium. I think they're 1-1-2 there.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing Leicester, who came off a much needed win against Man United 4-2.
Yeah.
I think it's go either way. I don't know if Brentford, another thing, like, have they gotten too hot too early? Like, everyone's kind of expecting them to perform. I don't know.
Yeah, that's another piece of, you know, compounded pressure. Now people are expecting us to win and put on those Chelsea Liverpool performances day in, day out.
Yeah, I think this one's going to be difficult because I know Leicester haven't started out well, but they're a good side.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with I think Leicester are going to win this, unfortunately. Even, you know what? No, I just back Brentford. We're going with 1-1 tie.
2-1 Brentford.
Up the bees.
Up the bees.
Up the bees. We should order some Brentford kits, I think.
Oh, I'm in. We'll do it at the end of the season when they're getting rid of them for like £10 each.
Yeah, we can AliExpress it or whatever.
All right, man. I think this was an awesome episode.
Yeah, another great episode. Episode 3 in the books. My name's Ian Stewart.
I'm Nader Afuni.
And this was the Super Subcast. Thank you for listening, everyone.
Thank you so much. Have a good day. We'll be right back.